All right, let's get started. So, last time I talked about toponymy and the board on geographic names and how names are important on maps. So today I'm going to take that one step further and look at geographic names or toponyms as part of our language and look at this issue of maps and language. And as Rush Limbaugh has just found out, your choice of words is very, very important in what happens. So I want to look at contested words and in particular show that maps can be used for political structures, but they can also be used to preserve bigotry and so on. We'll look at how the formal process that reviews and makes changes in today's lecture. Okay, now, come on. This is probably such a huge file. There we go. So, I really am not intending to offend anybody here today. I'm going to have to use certain words just so that the lecture makes sense. Okay, I will simply defer and dereference all of these comments because I'm not using my material here. I'm using Mark Monmanier's material. This is Mark. He's a professor at the University of Syracuse in New York. And the book that I'm leaning on in particular is called From Squaw Tit to Whorehouse Meadow, How Maps Name, Claim, and Inflame. So it's deliberately setting out to be controversial. It's an idea that I can't seem to place my copy of this. I have one, but it's out on extended loan somewhere. It's an idea that was first introduced in this book, Drawing the Line, Tales of Maps and Carto Controversy. So if you want to read a little bit further, there's one chapter in here. I'll pass it around so that you can take a look. So the chapters in his book cover some of the topics that he's run across and I've made the topic here. So the first thing on naming and mapping and the quest for a national gazetteer, in many respects we covered in the last lecture, so we should at least know that there is an international board on names that's coordinated by the United Nations, that it basically delegates authority to countries, and in the United States it's the Board on Geographic Names, which is currently chaired and run by the Department of the Interior, the U.S. Geological Survey. And for the rest of the world, as far as English is concerned, we deal with the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. So in many respects, we now have these national, in fact, international gazetteers. We can go to databases and look up any one of literally millions of place names in any one of dozens of different languages. So as soon as you start to look at the names of places on maps, you realize that people have been very creative in the way that they've come up with place names. And they've left in place all sorts of place names that you wouldn't expect. So pejoratives, insulting names very often find their way into maps. We'll look at some examples. Names for body parts and risque toponyms that probably should never have found their way in there in the first place. I'm going to look at this theme of going native, the idea of recovering and then recertifying original place names that were sort of obscured in the past. This is something that's happened quite a bit, certainly since the 1970s and 80s, and I'll show you some tangible examples. And as you'll see, this has political and public relations implications, quite a few. Your toponym or mine, whose place names do we choose? We'll look at one example there, the political controversy over, I'll just call it the high place. Some call it Mount McKinley, some call it Denali in Alaska. We'll look at that in particular. I'll cover very briefly a topic that Monmanier picks up a great deal more in the book, and that's the idea of erasures. If you want to conquer or occupy a territory, the first thing you start to do is to eliminate the traditional place names, and it's something that there are some good examples of. And then we'll finish up with this idea of inscriptions, commemorative naming of places. And that is, we've got how many Columbuses in the United States? We've got a District of Columbia. Pretty much every state has at least one Columbus. So there are a lot of place names in the U.S. that are commemorative of presidents, of explorers, and so on. We'll look at how that process happens as well. So let's first of all look at the BGN, the Board on Geographic Names rules for determining a place name. So you might, let's say you own some property, there's a hill on that property that you've always called My Hill, let's say, and you would like to have it officially approved as the name for My Hill. How do you go about doing it? Well, you have to go before the Board on Geographic Names, and they've used these five principles over the last 100 years for name standardization for the United States. And bear in mind, this is just the United States. Each country has its own specifications. So first of all, in English, we're going to use the Roman alphabet as employed in the English language. So you can't suddenly decide to use Cyrillic, let's say, or Kanji for a place name in the United States because it's not officially standard. Precedence is given to names in local usage. So local always beats national, which makes sense. So a county name would be preferred to a state-imposed name preferred to a federally enacted name. Names established by acts of Congress are official by law, and you'll see that is a double-edged sword, as we'll look at some of the commemorative examples later on. So you can simply decree that a name is going to be such, stick it onto one of these omnibus bills, it'll slip through at midnight. Nobody will notice that your mountain has suddenly been renamed. That can actually happen. Political subdivisions, bounded areas of administration, structures and establishments as determined by the appropriate responsible public normally are recognized as official. So this is because we have to do the census. So if a neighborhood is going to have a name that everybody is going to use the same name, or if a county is going to have a name where we're all going to agree that it's Santa Barbara County, we don't make changes once they've come about. And then the preference is for one name, one spelling, and one application authorized for each geographic entity. So if you come back in 10 years and try and rename the thing that you've just changed the name of, they're going to throw it out. They're just going to say, we're not going to keep changing the name of the same thing. There are some additional rules, and these are the ones we're going to start with today. So first of all, derogatory names or names that cause confusion are unacceptable. And confusion could be, Lost Hills or something like that. But we usually get derogatory names. I'll show you some examples in a minute. Duplicate names within a local political jurisdiction are not normally approved. So it's unlikely that we have two Columbus, Ohio's in the same state or two Santa Ynez's in the same county. And that's deliberate because you don't want the post office to get confused in delivering mail. Enormous areas in the United States are under federal control, either Bureau of Land Management or wilderness areas or national parks and forests. So within wilderness areas, unnamed features, the policy is for them to remain unnamed. So if there's a creek with no name on the map and you suddenly decide you want to name it for yourself, you can't do that if it's on federal land within a wilderness area. Unless the name is required for some reason. So if all of a sudden you need to name that creek because it's a place where you're going to deploy firefighters and where you're going to evacuate them under emergency conditions, there's a good helipad there, it needs a name, so it's okay to go ahead and name it in that instance. And even though you can have legal title and ownership over land, you can't be a dictator as far as naming is concerned. So you think of something like the King Ranch in Texas. That's a single ranch. It's larger than the entire state of Connecticut. It's owned by one family. You would think they would have jurisdiction over that land as far as naming is concerned. They do not. Okay, so just owning land is not sufficient as far as naming is concerned. So let's start with some of the pejoratives, and I'll show you that sometimes these can backfire. Generally speaking, the first real geographic information system was the Geographic Names Information System, which was created in the late 60s, early 1970s. They simply went across all the text on all 42,000 topographic maps and typed them into a database with the latitude and longitude of the feature. They didn't change anything. They just took whatever was on the map and typed it in. Okay, so the history of how these things got named goes back quite a long time. So we end up with things like Chinks Point here. I believe that's in Maine, I think. Jap Bay in Alaska. And Jap Bay was actually one of the instances where in the 70s and 80s, the board on geographic names concentrated on finding pejorative names within the US databases and then systematically eliminating them, changing the place names. And they applied the rules that I've just gone over. So this was the actual agreement in 1974 that changed Jat Bay, Alaska, agreed that the name Jat in geographic names be considered derogatory, to be avoided in federal publications by changing the name to Japanese Nisei, or by formally proposing another acceptable name. And this is often the choice that was taken to find some other way of naming the feature that still had meaning, still had some historical context. So that one's dated January 74. These started around that period, and there was a huge flood of them. Hundreds of features, literally, in this country got renamed within a very short space of time. But you have to be extremely careful when you start doing this. You know, you probably learned that if you want to change a word in a manuscript and you just simply do a bulk substitution of one word for another, you can easily create ridiculous circumstances in your own writing. Well, the same thing goes for pejorative names. So here's part of Maryland, for example, where we also have a Chink Creek. Could be considered derogatory. But Chink Creek, Maryland, turns out to actually have a Native American derivation. It's derived from Chinkwa. Translates to large or great. So this was actually a legitimate historical name that is probably every few years somebody's going to object to it and try and get it withdrawn as a place name. But nevertheless, the Board on Geographic Names has made a ruling that this name is going to stay in the database for historical reasons. Place names are kind of like statutes, you know. Once you eradicate them, they're gone, and nevertheless, they're kind of part of your history. If you think about, say, Paris or London, and all the people's statues who are commemorated there, or even New York. I was just in Columbus Circle in New York, for example. All the statues that commemorate people there have very checkered pasts. And eliminating all the statues, or eliminating all the place names, in one way is kind of disconnecting you from your culture. So this happened in the former Soviet Union. Well, we saw it happen in Iraq when the statues of the former leaders were destroyed or eliminated. So to some extent, you don't want to disconnect yourself with the past. Here's an interesting example of Swastika, Ontario. Okay, not exactly the name that you would choose. But if you go to India, swastikas are everywhere. They're a very common religious symbol that was used for thousands of years before the Nazi Party decided to use the swastika for its logo. Okay, so this town was named a long time before the Nazis chose a swastika as their symbol, Swastika, Ontario. And 1940, war breaks out in Europe, and it's proposed to rename the village after Winston Churchill, British leader in the war. And when the new sign got put up, the citizens of Swastika, Ontario ripped it down and put up a sign that said, "To hell with Hitler, we had the swastika first." So you could say that this is a good example of this local concept being embedded within the rules of the geographic names. If a bunch of people want to call their town something, that's fine. In this case, it's not derogatory. It's unfortunate. You'd probably not want to have a return address of Swastika, Ontario on your letterhead. But nevertheless, here it is. So there are lots more other than racial pejoratives as well, of course. Mamanir in his book talks about sex and feces, not the only non-racial names to incite objections. People will object to just about anything. So for some reason, the people who lived on Acid Factory Brook, Rhode Island, decided that they'd change the name of their creek to Factory Brook. Okay, and other places where similar things have happened, Cripple Creek, BS Gap in Arizona. Arizona has some great place names, I think, mostly, and Colorado. I think mostly states that had sort of pioneer miners that set up some of the first infrastructure. SOB Hill, Utah. Well, and SH Mountains, now the village of Kofa, Arizona. It was originally named SH Mountains by soldiers or miners because similarity of the lower peaks of the hills to outhouses. And then when ladies came to live there, they decided that was probably not a good idea, so they renamed them the Shorthorn Mountains in 1900, and later just completely changed the name altogether. So there are lots of ways to put an incorrect place name. I'll just point out one we have right here in Santa Barbara. If you walk down by the waterfront, We have Indio Muerto Street, or Dead Indian Street, right down here. Here it is on Google. So is that an appropriate name for a place? I don't know. If you wanted to challenge it, and you're entitled to, the challenge would go to the Board on Geographic Names. Here's one that Mamanir uses in his book that traditionally had been for many, many years on the maps. Here's the 1976 map, Whorehouse Meadow. There are some other interesting place names on this map. But you'll notice that that was, in the 68 quadrangle, somebody had renamed it Naughty Girl Meadow. And then in the 76 quadrangle, they changed it back to its original name, Whorehouse Meadow. So again, how names go backwards and forwards, and again, the BGN policy is not to repeatedly change names. But again, this happens. Different maps are going to show different things. So this is USGS and BLM, both using different names for the same place, two different federal agencies. Another pejorative, 15-minute quadrangle, Cowdersport, Pennsylvania. This is again another one from the title of the book, Squaw Peak and Squaw Peak Park, Sunnyside, Arizona. Greenhorn Mountains, 7.5-minute quadrangle, 1989. So I bet if you went back today and looked at these, you might find these changed. So this is, see this sort of handwritten writing? This means it's a provisional quadrangle, so it's still under review. It hasn't been fully processed and published yet. And of course, the huge opportunity to redo place names with the new GeoPDF format, topographic maps, was quite an opportunity. Some of these might be interesting to research, perhaps write your report on. Commodore, Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania seems to manage to get quite a lot of these in. Here's Jewtown. I would guess that there are probably hundreds of Jewtowns, Jewvilles, whatever, scattered throughout the United States. Is that pejorative? Again, it all has to be researched in terms of its local context. And often the state, or sometimes even the county, is the authority in the names, as we saw from the gazetteers that we briefly reviewed last time. Here's another reason. The shape is fairly obvious. The Brazier Hills. So is this a candidate for renaming or not? Who knows? I notice that it has a zipper creek coming out of it. So what has the BGN done? Well, it's prohibited local use of racially, ethnically, and scatologically offensive toponyms, and then tried to enforce it at the federal level, hoping that the usage will move down to the local level. Obviously, if somebody wants to call it the Brazier Hills, you're not going to be able to stop them. Free to call it whatever they like. But the federal government doesn't have to abide by those same place names. So here are some examples from the Map Room. If you've never seen the Map Room, it's a really fantastic blog on cartography that is very well worth following. So here's an interesting one. 1886, there's quite a long history here. Chinese laborer named Ha Ling worked as a cook in a mining camp near Canmore, Alberta, so we're in Canada, and he climbed a nearby mountain on a bet. So the peak he scaled became named locally as Chinaman's Peak. And that name was then given official status by the state and then the government of Canada based on historical usage. So in 1980, just when many place names are being weeded out, this one is now officially adopted as Chinaman's Peak. And then the campaign began immediately to have the name changed on the grounds that Chinaman was offensive and derogatory. So 1997, 17 years of debate over this place name, they finally decide that they're going to rename it, they're going to drop the name of the peak, and it's now known as Ha Ling Peak. Now that's a really good compromise when you think about it, because we lose the pejorative meaning of the word. We actually now commemorate something with a real name, which is much more in line with place naming standards, even though this is Canada. Makes it more historical and more interesting. Here's another one, the Canadian Pacific Railway. So there's some good examples from Canada here. The Kettle Valley Line changed the name in 1940 of something called Pétain. Now, Field Marshal Philippe Pétain, who was the hero of Verdun, the First World War, he was a French general who, you know, refused to surrender the town of Verdun in spite of hideous losses on both sides in World War I in the trenches. So this place was named for him, this town, but then, so it was called Pétain. In World War II, Pétain sort of agreed to collaborate with the Nazis and allow them to invade half of France, basically, if he could have control of the other half. So he made a deal with the enemy, and as a result, his name became anathema. And this town then decided to change its name, so they got rid of the name Pétain, and they called themselves Odlum, kind of strange name for a town. But the Pétain Glacier, which was nearby, kept its name, because it was not under the authority of the railroad. So here's an example of a private entity being able to name or rename something without national authority. And this is a good example of why something like a national coordinated board on geographic names is important. But here we've got a private company, a Canadian Pacific Railway, deciding what things are going to be called. This is one of my favorite place name errors in all of history. This is, unfortunately, this is in monochrome, but the original's in color. John Speed produced a beautiful series of county maps of England between 1610 and 1611. And very elegantly hand-drawn maps and nice terrain representation and so on. And here's the village of South Berkham, beautifully hand-lettered. And here's something he meant to go back and check later. So quare is the Latin term meaning query. This is something he wants to go back and check on to make sure it's correct. But of course, often a note that's left on the map then becomes printed and becomes part of the map. So here we are in 1685. We're now 75 years later, and somebody has simply copied the place name from the original map. So this village has now become called Query because somebody left themselves a note on the map. It's kind of like today we'd use a stick-it note, you know, to go and check this point. So completely artificial places can be created in exactly this way. I've used the example of Musharifa before in Palestine, where the British mappers would go in and ask them what the name of the town was, and they would say Musharifa. I don't know. So they would call it Musharifa. Here's another good one, and I like this one because it's controversial and not much is known about it, and that's the village of Novi, Michigan, which is just outside of Detroit. It's not very far from Detroit. So there's several popular but historically inaccurate explanations that have been given for the name Novi, and I must admit I'm partly guilty for having spread one of these. So one version of the place name, it was named after the sixth toll gate on the Grand River Toll Road. So in other words, there was a place name. There was a sign there that looked like this. Number six, and that got interpreted as Novi and became the place name Novi. But, of course, the township was named in 1832, given the name Novi, and the toll road was apparently not constructed until the 1850s, so that's probably not the origins of the place name. Similar claim was made about it being stop number six on the railroad. That seems a little bit more credible to me because I think this kind of sign is much more likely to be a railroad sign. The Holly, Wayne, and Monroe, now the CSX Railroad, was not constructed until even later, the 1870s, so 40 years after the name was chosen. So the name still remains a mystery. But the legend continues. This gets sort of thicker and thicker. The wiki page gets longer and longer as more and more people lay a claim to how Novi got its name. So the claim now is that the choice of the name goes back to 1830, a meeting discussing the separation from Farmington, a nearby township, and establishing their own identity in township. And they voted upon different place names and chose Novi from a list that included Republic and Beluha, which were up for consideration. The reason why they chose Novi is probably nobody ever knows. We'll probably never know. There's a letter kept at the City Hall from the Yugoslavian consulate in Chicago dated 1936, that talks about a link to a Yugoslavian soldier who fled to the United States to recover from a heartbreaking tale of a misadventure. And this doesn't, it begins to sound a little bit artificial, but of course there's no record of how such a soldier, of any such soldier that actually was involved in naming a place name in Michigan. So often we just have to accept that we don't know the origins of place name. To call it anything other than Novi would be false, because that's its historical name, that's what it's been known as. Personally, I like this story. I'll stick with this one regardless. Okay, the next topic is this idea of going native, of recovering and reusing and reallocating names that were eradicated, perhaps irrationally. And we've already looked at, and when we looked at the polar regions and Frobisher and so on, we saw the formation of Nunavut, this capital, Iqaluit here. And this is really an attempt to take an enormous land area within Canada and return it to native control, native legislation and governance, but then also the ability to recreate their own place names. Which in fact they've done. There's been a substantial amount of renaming. The creation of Nunavut was, as is always the case, a political compromise. So in establishing Nunavut, the native population had to agree to give up on all other claims to native lands within Canada. That's, again, it's an enormous area, in exchange for 10% of the land area of the country. But then also to give up all claims to mineral rights, Nunavut or anywhere else. So even though they own the land, they don't own the oil or the gold or whatever might be underneath it. Here's an interesting little piece, and this is out of the book, where we've got I just call it clashing cultures. If you've traveled out to Hawaii and been around a little bit, you'll notice that Hawaii is this unusual mixture of cultures from the get-go. Originally a Polynesian-based culture, a kingship that was dethroned largely fraudulently in the modern era before it became a U.S. state. It was taken over by the landholders and the people that were plantation owners there. And they largely set about eliminating all native place names. In fact, it was banned to speak the native language in the schools for a very long time within Hawaii. So now we've got a conflict of old place names in the native language, and then new place names that are largely coming along and being given Western names. And now we have this interesting third culture coming in to Hawaii, the people who want to name surf spots or want to develop the coastline for condos and other reasons. So, if any of you are surfers, you probably realize there are all these names for the surfing spots up and down the coast here that are highly localized. You know, Pillars, Juniors, Turtles, and so on, that often get used for local spots here in California too. So here we've got this wonderful combination of Aina, Haina, is that on Maui? Oh, no, that's on. These are all on Oahu. And Kahala, native names for a neighborhood, but this is Diamond Head Crater. That's obviously named since settlement, and not since statehood, but before that. And then we have the surfers with their own names for areas, and things like Sunset Beach. And then native names for the settlements, mostly inhabited by Hawaiians. So you've got this strange mixture. The map C down there at the bottom is where some awesome surf is located, that north shore of Oahu. Okay, so let's get on to this this idea of controversy around names and the meaning of them and how it can be politically sustained and why something like a BGN is so important, even though we sort of don't know much about its role. This is the highest point in the United States. It's in Alaska. I could give you the latitude and longitude. The native name for it, Denali, means the high one. pretty reasonable name for a very high mountain. Its original name in Denali was an Athabascan word, meaning the high one. It's also been given other Native American names. It's the highest peak in North America. In 1896, it acquired the name Mount McKinley after McKinley was assassinated. He became president, then was assassinated in 1901. There was a whole bunch of commemorative naming for things for McKinley, just as there was for John Kennedy after he was assassinated in the 1960s. So we have JFK Airport in New York City, for example. The Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. So the choice was by a single person, William A. Dickey, a prospector who admired McKinley's vigorous defense of the gold standard. So he named it for him when he was a Republican presidential candidate. William McKinley named it Mount McKinley. So problem there automatically, because he's still alive. Not only still alive, he's politically active. He's running for Congress, running for president, rather. So this went about for a very long time. In the 1970s, Native Alaskans started their campaign to restore the name Denali, which had been taken away under this commemorative naming. In 1980, with the support of Alaskans, peeved that McKinley had never visited or had any kind words whatsoever for Alaska, they convinced the National Park Service to change the name of Mount McKinley National Park to Denali National Park. Okay, so this is a federal entity, it's a national park, but we can have a name change at that level with board and BGN approval. That makes some sense, but it still hasn't changed the name of the mountain. It's still officially Mount McKinley. Okay, so these during the 1970s onward, one single Republican congressman, Ralph Regula, was elected in 1973 and served 18 terms in Congress. He continuously thwarted every effort by Alaskans to rename Mount McKinley as Denali. And he did this by taking advantage of a loophole in the law that allowed the automatic, if something is also being considered by Congress of the executive branch, it could not come up for a vote in Congress. So he simply continuously sort of personally vetoed any attempt to change the name, even though Alaska continues to annually try and get the name changed back to Alaska. Well, why? He represents McKinley's hometown of Canton, Ohio, and he saw that commemorative name as being important for his electorate. So every 2 years, a few days after a new Congress convenes, Regula introduced a bill calling for the mountain to retain the name McKinley, and then it got shelved, which meant it was under consideration, so the name couldn't be changed. And it happened over and over and over again. Well, Ralph Regula retired from Congress in January 2009 after 18 terms in office. And this change was introduced in Alaska by the Alaskan legislature in 1975. So we've got it, you know, many, many years later. So the successors, U.S. Representatives Betty Sutton and Tim Ryan, both of Ohio, have taken on Regula's role of vetoing this law every 2 years. So they've introduced Home Rule 229, which reads, notwithstanding any other authority of law, the mountain located 63 degrees 4 minutes 12 seconds north by 151 degrees 0 minutes 18 seconds west shall continue to be named and referred to for all purposes in Mount McKinley. And because that can never come up to a vote in Congress because it's under continuous executive action, nothing has changed. And state and commercial mapmakers have honored the board's action, the BGN's action, so Mount McKinley remains the name, in at least as far as the federal government is concerned, even though the national park that it's contained within has been renamed. That's, there you go. So we end up with, this is a national sanctioned National Parks map, in which the state park is called Denali State Park, but the mountain itself is labeled as Mount McKinley, and this is a federal area, a Denali National Park and Preserve. So we've got the federal mapping out of touch with the local. So here's the USGS quad that labels it quite clearly as Mount McKinley here. That's the official name as far as BGN is concerned because of this act. But if you go to Alaska and get a local map and look at what it's called, you'll see that from the Alaska federal government point of view, from the act they passed in 1975, it's the Denali National Park, and the mountain within it is called Denali 2. So, surprisingly, a lot of people get bent out of shape over things like this, over what we call a mountain. And these can be obvious, like the names of the highest mountain in the United States, and they can not so obvious. So here's one that did take some lobbying, quite an extensive amount. Here's the 1954 quadrangle. I believe this is also maybe on Maui. Hold on. It's the 1A quad. I forget which one. So take a look at these diacriticals in the local language, in the Hawaiian language, which uses diacritical marks. This is now almost meaningless. It's a series of words that are unconnected together into a sound. But that was corrected in the new version. You notice that the separation of the words, the uppercase words, have now disappeared, except for the second full word. And we've correctly, and I don't even want to know how to say that. So let me guess that it's Puahuluuka. This mountain gets renamed, and finally, by 1998, it's been correctly named on the topographic map with the diacriticals in place. Diacriticals have been a controversial issue for a long time. When the Ordnance Survey and the Automobile Association in Britain got locked into a political argument about copyright infringement on their maps, this is about 10 years ago, it boiled down to possessive, like Jones Street or Jones's Street. Whether or not the apostrophe was there. They would often claim that copying the apostrophe was violation of the copyright because they made up what it should be. Now, as far as your toponym or mine is concerned, we have lots and lots of instances where what something is called becomes a political football. Okay, we've seen it over Denali, but in this case, it's over what we call an entire sea. So here's the CIA map of North Korea. Very little doubt about the capital, Pyongyang. We've even got the diacritical marks in it. We've got them in the city names too. But this little piece of text here, if you go to South Korea, is one of the most controversial and political things you could ever imagine. The Sea of Japan. A lot of people in this part of the world don't like Japan very much because of what happened before and during World War II. So, way too much text here, my apologies. Korea set out to systematically prove its case about this. They formed Korea.net, the National Geographic Information Institute, which is part of the Ministry of Construction and Transportation in Korea, did a study in 2008 and released the study and used it as the basis on which they were proposing that the sea be renamed by everybody. Everybody changed the name of that sea. I won't tell it what it's going to be called. The study looked at 400 historical maps of the United States, France, England, and other European nations that included the Korean Peninsula to see how it's been labeled. It includes reviews of quite rare Western maps of the Korean Peninsula, and it includes Korean toponyms and naming of topography, proper names of places like Donghae, Gando, I won't bother with the rest of those, and how this changed the image of Korea abroad, at least according to the English part of the report, that's legible. So the bottom line is Korea began to appear on Western maps starting in the mid-16th century, and for the first 200 years at least, Korea was illustrated as an island instead of a peninsula. As we've seen on a lot of these old maps, originally they wanted all these islands to be there. By the 18th century, 19th century, more specific information began to be labeled. on the East Sea and its islands, like Dokdo. On a particular map, the Lapis map, which was published in France in 1832, it marked the South China Sea as the Sea of China. This is a misnomer. And the East China Sea as the Sea of Korea. So they changed the name of the East China Sea. And the present East Sea, that's the contentious one, as the Sea of Japan. So the mislabeling, from their point of view, of the Korean Sea as the Sea of, or the East Sea as the Sea of Korea, the Sea of Japan, dates back to that particular map from 1832 in France, not even in Southeast Asia. So the East Sea, what they call Donghai, was marked Sea of Korea, or Mer de Corée, the Sea of Korea, in the 17th century on England's Senex map, France's map of the Japanese Empire, and so on. And these predate that later French map, which did the relabeling. So they argue that before the Sea of Korea took hold, the water was referred to as the Sea of China, and what's currently labeled as the Sea of Japan was actually the East Sea. So they started arguing that this should be its official name. So here's the map in question that calls it the Eastern or Korea Sea. And here's Japan. Pretty awful rendering of the Korean Peninsula there, but China's not so bad. So these labels become very important in how you want something to be labeled or how you want to argue that something should be seen. Here we've got completely different. This is the 1832 French map. Is the source of all the, they believe, mislabeling, where the Korean Sea was moved down here to the China Sea, and the Sea of Japan became the label for the what they had called the East Sea. May seem irrelevant, but in Korea they get really bent out of shape about things like this. So there is now a group on this, based on this website, that treats itself as the watchdog. They go trolling the web, looking at major mapping agencies, looking for instances where people are using the text Sea of Japan to label what they want to call the East Sea, and then taking it upon themselves as their responsibility to tell them that they had to label their map correctly. So here's some of the entries from emails that they've sent. Such an error in a well-known website as yours becomes as a surprise, since we regard you as one of the world's best. This is to people like National Geographic and the NGA. Using a proper name for the body of water between the Korean Peninsula and the Japanese archipelago is not simply a question of changing the name of a geographical feature. It is rather a part of a national effort by the Korean people to erase the legacy of Japanese imperialism and to redress the unfairness that has resulted from it. And so I urge you to use both East Sea, to use East Sea to describe the body of water in question. Quite interesting. So here's a really a political lobbying group trying to redress a historical incident, Japan's invasion of Korea and China in the 1920s and 30s, and to do it by commemorative naming. Big issue. Let's move on to this issue of erasure. How do you erase something from the face of the earth if you want to do that? Well, you just simply don't name it. Or you don't include that name in your maps. You literally take it off the map. So here's an example. This is also out of Mamanir's book, so don't claim this is me. This is the 1:6 2500 survey of Palestine, 1943, the British mapping effort. Incidentally, I've been writing the chapter on aerial mapping for the book I'm working on right now, and Palestine was one of the first places systematically mapped by aerial photography, other than the trenches of France in World War I. So here we Tal is an archaeological remain, and we have a town quite clearly called Al Birwa here. So, and another town down here. So we've got quite obvious places. Notice that this is a military map, so this is marked as a landing ground. They're always trying to pick out flat areas where they could drop paratroopers at this time. Now we fast forward into the future. So this is the Sheet 3, Haifa, the 1 to 100,000 map of Israel, published in 1988. Okay, so it's been enlarged to the same scale as the other one and cropped so that the areas correspond. Now, a few things to notice here is, first of all, a lot of the place names are even though they're originally in Arabic, are being translated into Hebrew. So it's the, it's the official language, so they're doing it. What happened? Here's Yeshua. And here is Al-Birwa, but it's been labeled something else. Okay. So what's going on here? Well, we've got a new settlement being created here, Jewish settlement being created in Israel, and a population imported and placed in. And to make it legitimate, they're simply erasing what was already on the ground there beforehand. Just check this map. Here's Yeshua, here's Al-Birwa. A lot closer than that. If I zoom in on Google Earth and take a look at what's actually there on the ground, here's Yeshua, a great deal further south than it's depicted on the maps. But here is the planned Jewish settlement of Yeshua with its industry. And here's the much larger traditional settlement that's been there for hundreds of years. This doesn't even warrant a place name label on the 1 to 100,000 series Israeli maps. Mominir argues in the book that this is systematic. It was done throughout Palestine during modern times and continues indeed right up to today. So here I've attempted to, you can do this in Google Earth, you can bring an image in and try and co-register it. So I'm trying to here I'm trying to show that at least you go to the 1943 map, you can see that here's Al-Birwa and it's correctly labeling this settlement up here. And that this settlement, Tal Abir, is actually a very old settlement, has been erased and it now has the name Yasur. So this is an example of that of Mamanir's book, but you wouldn't have to troll around maps of Israel very long to find many good examples of this. Now let's wrap up with this topic of inscriptions and commemorative names. This place is sort of world famous. I'm not even going to begin to pronounce this name. It's a Welsh traditional name in Wales, but most people abbreviate it to Landfair. I love the way it ends, is Gogogoch. And there have been many debates about how this place name got set about. It's probably, in recent times, it was established just to be the world's longest place name, which it in fact is not. There are several other places with longer names, including the official name of Bangkok, which actually is not one word, so it doesn't really count as a single place name. So trying to get in the Guinness Book of World Records now becomes a motive for how you name your settlements. But I think what they were really saying here when they were renaming the settlement was that the Welsh language was in danger of complete elimination, linguistic elimination. That there were so few native speakers that without government effort it would have disappeared. And actually the BBC took a very active role. They created a Welsh language television station just for Wales, Welsh radio stations that have pretty much single-handedly kept the language alive. So this is about language activism, about people wanting to commemorate place names. So it's very much like the Nunavut names that we saw earlier. And it continues today. I'll point this out. This is a little bit old now. It's from 2008. But I'll read this out. This is from reaganlegacy.blogspot.com. The mission of the Ronald Reagan Legacy Project is to honor the legacy of our 40th president, Ronald Reagan. The Reagan Legacy Project aims to fulfill its mission by naming sufficient public landmarks after President Reagan in the 50 states and over 3,000 counties of the United States, as well as in formerly communist countries across the globe. Now, that's kind of an ambitious goal. For more information, contact, blah, blah, blah. Now, this group has been enormously successful. They renamed Washington National Airport, the Reagan National Airport. They have support from a foundation based here in Santa Barbara, the Young America Foundation, and it is indeed their goal to name something in every single state. Notice from the date of this, they started this naming process before Reagan even died. So again, it's violating one of the BGN rules. So let's go over commemorative naming. because there's an enormous amount of it, obviously. So, section one, BGN will consider proposals for assignment of the names or nicknames, so it doesn't have to be the actual name, of deceased persons to geographical features in the United States and areas under the jurisdiction of the United States. So there's no way we can name things in communist, formerly communist countries. They would have to do that voluntarily. The board will not consider names that commemorate or may be construed to commemorate living persons. Very important restriction here. Somebody's got to be dead for at least 5 years before it's appropriate to start naming things after them. The person being honored by the naming should either have had a direct long-term association with the feature or have made a significant contribution to the area or state in which it's located. Now that eliminates the McKinley naming for Denali, you know, because McKinley never even went to Alaska and could hardly be argued as the world's greatest president. A proposal commemorating an individual with an outstanding national or international reputation will be considered even if the person was not directly associated with the geographic feature. So here you have to prove exceptionality, and this is the rule that the Reagan namers are going for. They're arguing that this is, you know, one of the great presidents, and therefore things need to be named after him. So this would be the argument for naming something after Christopher Columbus, for example. And all commemorative name proposals must meet the same basic criteria required of any other name proposal. So they have to meet the criteria that I started today's lecture with. You would think that these rules would be sufficient, but in many cases they are not. So the nice thing about place names, a couple of nice things about place names, is that they're all recorded in the databases. So we can very easily find out cool place names just by doing searches in the databases or just by looking at the place name lists. And the GNIS allows you to download the name of every single feature in any state if you want to as a spreadsheet file, and you can just search it yourself. But then the incredible diversity of place names in the United States is just a never-ending source of sort of entertainment. Well, just by finding out how places inside and outside the U.S. got their names. So here's a lost island in, I believe it's Alabama, and we have a lost hills nearby to us right here in California. This one was called Lost Nation, and I don't believe that's actually a place name. It's sort of a resort or something. But I once found a wonderful account of a place called Fictitious Place. And it was actually a part of a training manual for people who were going to do tourist site promotions. And they'd been given all these details and plans about this place called Fictitious Place. But somehow they've actually managed to make it sound like it was a real place. So there were people who believed that there really was a town called Fictitious Place. I think that's cool. Cool California. Yes, there really is a cool California. It's up in the Sierra foothills near Sacramento, named for somebody whose last name was Cool, not by a bunch of hippies as you might expect. Here's another of my favorites, Turkey, Texas. It's another country. It's commemorative to some extent. And then my all-time favorite, Nowhere, Oklahoma, which I'm using as a little bit of a theme for the new book I'm working on. The stories about Nowhere are actually known because it only goes back a couple of generations. But a Californian moved to the middle of Oklahoma to this spot. It's actually near a fairly large reservoir, so there's a lot of fishing going on there. And bought a house and had a big corn silo or water tower or something outside of it. And the wife, who was also from California, told the husband that he'd brought her to the middle of nowhere. So one day for a prank, he went up and painted Nowhere on the water tank, just the letters Nowhere. And that became adopted as the name for the grocery store, the Nowhere, and which is now a post office. So now it gets a place name designation of Nowhere. So Nowhere, Oklahoma. There it is. It's a legitimate place. Lots of good, fascinating examples of place names. Researching a place name and the origins of a place name and the evolution of a place name can be absolutely fascinating. London, the city of London, for example, has had at least 5 different place names over time. Even something like New York has had multiple place names. It was once New Amsterdam. So I would encourage you, if you're still thinking about a topic for what to write about for the class, just spend 5 minutes looking through the GNIS. I think you'll find some really amazing stuff in there. All right, that's all I was going to talk about today. Any time? Plenty of time for any questions? Yes.
You said one of the rules is that you can't just get a place name, you can't get a hill named on your own property just because it's on your property.
Correct.
I'm assuming
in the United States
that there's loopholes. You mentioned building a helicopter pad or something. Are there things that people